The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is George Douglas from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we're reading from The Week magazine, dated April 13th, 2012. And thanks for joining me today. We'll begin with the main story section of The Week magazine. And our first item is entitled, Romney on the Verge of Victory. What happened? Republican voters and leaders anointed Mitt Romney, their presumptive presidential candidate, this past week as he won a trio of primary contests and a wave of key endorsements. Romney scored a decisive 7-point victory in Wisconsin, where his chief rival, Rick Santorum, had campaigned relentlessly in search of an upset win. With easy wins in Maryland and Washington, D.C., Romney has now amassed over half the delegates required to secure the nomination. Santorum said he would fight on, but the race is now shifting to the general election bout between Romney and President Obama. And as a footnote, as you may know, of course, this happened after the Week magazine went to press, Santorum this week has bowed out of the race. Key Republican figures endorsed Romney last week, including former President George H.W. Bush, former Florida Governor Jeb Bush, and Representative Paul Ryan of Wisconsin. We need to coalesce around Mitt Romney and focus on the big task at hand, said Ryan, which is defeating Barack Obama in the fall. President Obama signaled that he considered Romney his challenger, mentioning him by name in a speech for the first time this week. Obama criticized Romney's support for the House Republican budget proposed by Ryan, which he derided as social Darwinism. Romney fired back in Wisconsin on Tuesday night, characterizing Obama as an out-of-touch leader who has surrounded himself with an adoring staff of true believers. Now here's what the editorial said. Santorum had his chance to prove himself the champion of conservatives, said the Wall Street Journal, but he has failed. Even self-described Tea Party supporters backed Romney over Santorum in Wisconsin, and GOP reform leaders like Ryan have given him ringing endorsements. Santorum says he'll remain in the race to force a decision at the convention, but without an issue or rationale to rally Republicans with, he ought to ask himself what purpose is served by continuing to stay in the race. Now comes Romney's etch-a-sketch moment, said Bloomberg.com. Can he shake the slate clean of the hard right positions he has taken on immigration, tax reform, and social issues, and emerge as a moderate Republican once again? Let's hope so, said the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. The moderate inclinations he has shown in the past on issues such as health care and the environment make him the best candidate to attract independent swing voters. If Romney rejects the worst impulses of the political right, President Obama could have a real fight on his hands. Now here's what the columnist said. The race may be all but over, said John Dickerson in Slate.com, but Romney is left with a badly battered image. Only 35% of independent voters view him favorably, and 52% say they don't like him. Obama now has an 18-point lead over Romney with female voters. The question now is, how does Romney fix all of this? Not easily, said Eugene Robinson in the Washington Post. Come the fall, Romney will still be Romney, and his image as an uninspiring flip-flopper unable to connect with ordinary people is now stamped in voters' minds. If Romney thinks he can etch-a-sketch that away, he's got an awful lot of shaking to do. The good news for Republicans, said William Kristol in the Weekly Standard, is that this former Bain executive has experience in turning around an enterprise that's likely to fail. To defeat Obama, Romney now has to pivot from a negative tone to a bolder, more forward-looking message, offering voters a clear choice of paths for the future. He would be wise to drift back to the political center, too, said Timothy Stanley in CNN.com. A subtle shift in tone on social issues could help bring female voters back to the Republican fold. Whatever happens next, said Michael Gerson in the Washington Post, the general election campaign already looks more like a contest of the wounded than a clash of the titans. Romney's image problems may make him a weak candidate, but Obama looks just as vulnerable. His approval ratings are still below 50%, with many voters unconvinced by his performance on the economy, job creation, and health care. Poll after poll shows him losing to a generic Republican opponent. But to deliver on that promise, Romney will have to prove to voters that he's something more than a generic Republican. Our next item, seeking facts in the Martin case. The parents of Trayvon Martin this week call for federal officials to investigate the prosecutor who decided not to charge their son's killer. The family alleges that State Attorney Norm Wolfinger, who has since stepped down from the case, met with the Sanford, Florida police chief hours after the 17-year-old's death and overruled a detective's recommendation that the shooter, Neighborhood Watch volunteer George Zimmerman, be charged with manslaughter. Wolfinger dismissed the allegations as outright lies and said no such meeting took place. Zimmerman claims that he shot Martin in self-defense after the unarmed black teen assaulted him, but his account was called into question by two audio forensic experts who concluded that a voice heard calling for help moments before the shooting, captured on a neighbor's 911 call, was not Zimmerman's, as his supporters claimed. Right-wing pundits have been disturbingly quick to defend Zimmerman, said David Carr in the New York Times. DrudgeReport.com, a conservative blog, published numerous stories casting doubt on how much of a victim Trayvon was. The site claimed he had been repeatedly suspended from school and published pictures of the teen striking hip-hop poses. The facile implication was that the young man was obviously well acquainted with thug life and got what he deserved. If anyone has sought to prejudice this case, it's the left-leaning media, said Victor Davis Hansen in NationalReview.com. The Today Show aired a version of Zimmerman's 911 call in which he said that Martin was up to no good and that he looks black. That second sentence came after the operator asked about Martin's race. By editing the question out, Today made Zimmerman seem like a racist bigot. And despite media assertions that a police video proved Zimmerman suffered no injuries in scuffling with Martin, careful analysis of the tape seems to reveal a gash on his scalp. We simply don't know if this was a case of justifiable homicide, murder, or something in between, said James Taranto in WSJ.com. Conservatives and liberals are foolish to defend or damn Zimmerman before all the evidence is in. His guilt or innocence turns on the facts of the case, not any ideological belief. We all have to depend on due process and the rule of law. The next item from the main story section today is Egypt's Islamists assert power. Reversing an earlier pledge, Egypt's Muslim Brotherhood announced it will field a candidate for next month's presidential election. It named Karat el-Shatir, 61, a top leader of the Islamist party, who was jailed several times under the Mubarak regime. The Brotherhood already controls both houses of parliament, even though it had previously promised to run for just a few seats. It also reneged on a pledge to allow liberals and Christians a hand in writing the new constitution, and instead packed the committee with Islamists. The announcement of El-Shatir's candidacy sent an earthquake through Cairo's already wildly careening political scene, said Mark Lynch in Foreign Policy. For months, the Muslim Brotherhood was vehement in its insistence that it would not field a candidate, even going so far as to expel a reformist member who insisted on running. Many Egyptians will surely see this as a part of a long-hatching conspiracy to turn Egypt back into a one-party state. The Brotherhood is taking a huge gamble, said Rula Khalaf in the Financial Times. Defeat would be enormously embarrassing, but victory also carries tremendous risk. If El-Shater wins, his party, which has zero experience in governing, will have sole responsibility for all of Egypt's political institutions at a time of deep economic malaise and exceedingly high popular expectations. The Brotherhood would fully own every setback. You know who's not worried? The U.S., said Tony Karen in Time.com. The Brotherhood, after all, is less extreme than Egypt's other prominent Islamist group, the Salafists. Without a Brotherhood candidate, the entire Islamist vote would go to the Salafist candidate, Hazem Salah Abu Ismail, who talks of emulating Iran's theocratic political system and of ending the peace treaty with Israel. U.S. officials vastly prefer El-Shater, a millionaire businessman and father of ten who is seen as a pragmatist and a modernizer. In fact, many observers believe the Brotherhood broke its pledge because it was worried that the Salafists would take the presidency, an outcome as unpalatable to the Brotherhood as it would be to Washington. And now we'll turn to the controversy of the week from the Week magazine entitled Healthcare, Will the Supreme Court Judge Fairly? This is supposed to be a democracy, said E.J. Dionne in the Washington Post, not a judicial dictatorship. Before last week's Supreme Court hearings on President Obama's health care law, most legal experts, even conservative ones, assumed it would be upheld. While the individual mandate requiring all citizens to buy health insurance may be unpopular and politically controversial, it's supported by previous rulings on what the Constitution's Commerce Clause permits, and the law was duly passed by both houses of Congress. But then along came last week's barrage of skeptical questions and weird hypotheticals. Could the government make citizens eat broccoli from the court's conservative majority? The right-wing judges seemed far more interested in handing a political defeat to Obama than in fairly interpreting the Constitution. If the justices throw out Obamacare, said David Savage in the Los Angeles Times, it will be the first time since 1936 that the Supreme Court voided a major federal regulatory law. Notice will have been served to the nation that it's entered a new era of judicial activism. We told you so, said John Podhoretz in the New York Post. Conservatives have been patiently explaining for the past 2 years that the law's individual mandate isn't constitutional. It's an unprecedented intrusion on people's freedom that, as Justice Anthony Kennedy suggested, changes the relationship of the federal government to the individual in a very fundamental way. Yet until last week, liberals had their fingers stuck in their ears singing, "La, la, la, I'm not listening." Liberals are trapped in a groupthink bubble, said Jonah Goldberg in NationalReview.com. They just know the health care law is constitutional because all of their liberal friends say so. If the court overturns it, they'll see it as evidence of rank partisanship and right-wing judicial activism, rather than, say, the court fulfilling its most basic function by overturning an unconstitutional law. Not all of us were surprised last week, said Jonathan Chait in NYMag.com. Most liberals, like most Americans, have known since Bush versus Gore that the court's conservative bloc puts its own partisan and ideological leanings above a strict interpretation of the law. Yet even some conservative legal experts were taken aback at the political tone of last week's hearings, said Dahlia Lithwick in Slate.com. Former Reagan Solicitor General Charles Freed said he was shocked to hear the conservative justices trotting out the most tendentious of the Tea Party-type arguments against the law, rather than addressing its legal merits. By the third day of oral arguments, when several justices mused about throwing poor people off the Medicaid rolls, the line between a Rush Limbaugh segment and oral argument at the highest court in the land had all but evaporated. "We owe the court more respect than that," said Ruth Marcus in WashingtonPost.com. "I personally believe the health care bill is constitutional, but it isn't a slam dunk. What I heard last week at the Supreme Court was a group of fine legal minds wrestling with a legitimate, even difficult, constitutional question. Whatever decision they reach, we owe it to the court and to ourselves to assume they reached it in good faith. Let's hope they decide by a clear majority either way," said Akhil Amar in Slate.com, "rather than a 5-4 party line split. Some agreement among liberal and conservative judges would give their ruling credibility and douse the partisan fires. That is what America now needs and needs desperately from the highest court in the land." Now, from the controversy of the week, we will turn to the popular column, Good Week 4 and Bad Week 4. It was a good week for leveraging your position after Greg Smith, the ex-Goldman Sachs executive who resigned in a highly critical New York Times column, signed a $1.5 million book deal. The book will include more details of the toxic culture Smith found so repugnant. It was a good week for intellectual property lawyers after Yahoo filed a lawsuit against Facebook over alleged patent infringements, and Facebook countersued. Previously, Apple sued Samsung, and both British Telecom and Oracle sued Google. And it was a good week for thrift shopping after Zach Bodish of Ohio bought a print of a crudely etched face at a thrift store for $14. It turned out to be an original signed Pablo Picasso print. It was a bad week for the myth of student athletes after the University of Kentucky won the national basketball championship and its five starters, all freshmen and sophomores, indicated they'd quit college and file for the NBA draft. It was a bad week for fix-uppers after a house in Ferry Hill Station, England, sold for $13,125 at auction, making it Britain's cheapest house. The two-bedroom house is 100 yards from a train track and features missing ceilings, a destroyed kitchen, and lots of graffiti. And it was a bad week for bragging after a car with a bumper sticker reading, "Why am I the only person on the planet who knows how to drive?" collided with a guardrail on a New York City highway and flipped over. The driver suffered non-life-threatening injuries, including a bruised ego. And now we'll turn to the People's section in the Week magazine this week. The first item is entitled, How Moss Was Tricked by Love. Elizabeth Moss is heartbroken, said Carrie Sem in Page Six magazine. For a moment there, back in 2008, the Mad Men star was convinced she'd met Mr. Right in comedian Fred Armisen. The couple hit it off after Moss did a cameo on Saturday Night Live and were married a year later. But things took an unexpected turn after just 8 months when Armisen abruptly left Moss for fellow SNL cast member Abby Elliott, who is 22 years his junior. "It's so hard to talk about," says Moss of her time with Armisen. "One of the greatest things I heard someone say about him is he's so great at doing impersonations, but the greatest impersonation he does is that of a normal person. To me, that sums it up." Despite her disastrous last romance, Moss says she's still looking for a comedian. "To me, a guy that can make you laugh is everything. When you're old and gray, you're going to want someone that can make you laugh. That said," she adds, "a pretty face in the morning is lovely." After Armisen, one more qualification exists for her next mate, says Moss. Honesty, honesty, and honesty. The next item, the lawyer who helped turn Lohan around. Sean Holly works miracles for troubled starlets, said Sandy Banks in the Los Angeles Times. Just last week, she performed her latest marvel when she managed to get Lindsay Lohan freed from probation, the culmination of a five-year courtroom drama that saw multiple lawyer and hair color changes and at least one vulgar message painted on a fingernail. It's been a strange journey for Holly, a former public defender, who began her legal career in dirty holding tanks interviewing crack addicts and petty thieves. Most frustrating has been watching Lohan ignore her advice and repeatedly screw up. Holly even quit once. It took a long time for us to have a relationship of mutual trust and respect, she says. For the most part now, I think she listens to me. And that means a lot, it really does. So what was it that allowed her to get through to the actress? In a sense, it is material, says Holly, who's also raising a 9-year-old daughter. I do feel like her protector, and I really consider it an honor to protect her. She hopes people recognize the difficult time Lohan has had under the spotlight, and that they'll now give her space to write her life. Think about your own lives, your own children, the mistakes that have been made, and how much more painful and difficult it would be if there was a crowd around calling off with her head. The next item from the People's section is entitled, Still Mourning on E Street. Bruce Springsteen misses the big man, said Jon Stewart in Rolling Stone, nearly a year after Clarence Clemons, legendary saxophone player and backbone of Springsteen's E Street Band, passed away following a stroke. Springsteen is nowhere close to getting over the loss. Clemons' death came suddenly during sessions for the band's new album. The record was pretty much done, except that I wanted to get Clarence on it, he recalls. I called him to come in and record. He was having problems with the feeling in his hand. He was worried and asked if he could go home to Florida first and have it checked out. It was the first time Clarence passed on a recording session. Within a week, Clemons had the stroke. I flew down and spent the week at his bedside. In the first few days, he would squeeze my hand when he heard my voice. Then things got worse. Clemons left behind one last musical gift, a solo from one of his last performances that a producer inserted into one of the new album tracks. When the solo section hit, Clarence's sax filled the room. I cried. So he's there, through a little technical magic, but he's there, says the boss. He played beautifully. Now we'll take a look at the section called The Briefing in The Week magazine. This week's briefing is entitled The Battle for the U.S. Senate. The presidential election isn't the only important race this year. Which party controls Congress may be just as critical. Is the Senate up for grabs? Many Republicans think it is and are quietly arguing that their odds of success there are higher than in defeating the incumbent president, Barack Obama. As a result, they're urging party operatives to focus their energies on the attainable goal of winning a Senate majority rather than focus too heavily on the presidential race. Democrats currently have only a slim 53-47 majority in the Senate, and of the 33 seats being contested this year, 10 are currently held by Republicans and 23 by Democrats. 10 sitting senators are retiring, the highest number since 1996, and 7 of them are Democrats. Even if Obama is reelected, some Republicans argue Republican majorities in both houses of Congress could block the president's initiatives, stop him from appointing liberal judges or other officials, and exert real influence over the national agenda. I think this election is more about the Senate than the presidency, said Senator Jim DeMint, a Republican from South Carolina. If we don't have a majority with a strong conservative voice in the Senate and a majority in the House, then it doesn't matter what we have in the White House. How could the Republicans win a majority? Well, the party needs to pick up a net total of 4 seats, and its likeliest gains are seats now held by Democratic senators in traditionally red states. Ben Nelson of Nebraska and Kent Conran of North Dakota are retiring this year, and the GOP has good chances in open elections in these conservative states. In Ohio, Democrat Sherrod Brown is considered vulnerable to Tea Party-endorsed Josh Mandel. And in Florida, Bill Nelson faces a popular opponent in Representative Connie Mack. Republicans are also targeting seats in Virginia, New Mexico, and Hawaii, where Democratic senators are retiring. Of these, Republicans have the best odds in Virginia, where former Republican Governor George Allen is running neck and neck with former Democratic Governor Tim Kaine. Could the GOP retain all 10 of its uncontested seats? That's unlikely. Democrats see some opportunities of their own in November. Republicans face a tough challenge in trying to hold on to the main Senate seat of retiring moderate Olympia Snow. The race's current frontrunner, independent Angus King, is likely to caucus with the Democrats. And while polls currently give Senator Scott Brown, the Republican from Massachusetts, a healthy lead in a tough re-election battle against Democrat challenger Elizabeth Warren, she has a formidable fundraising advantage as a nationally known consumer advocate and opponent of big banks. In Nevada, the Republican incumbent Dean Heller, appointed after scandal-plagued John Ensign, resigned last year, faces a close race against Representative Shelley Berkley. But with so few GOP seats in play, the Democrats have to retain most of the contested seats they now hold in order to remain in the majority. How hard will that be? Well, the Democrats are vulnerable in several of these races. They had high hopes in Nebraska last month after Bob Kerry, a former Democratic governor and senator, announced that he would seek Ben Nelson's seat. But polls show Kerry, a Vietnam veteran who has lived in New York for years, trailing Republican John Brunning, the state's attorney general, by a 17-point margin. Democrats think they have a better chance in North Dakota, where former State Attorney General Heidi Heitkamp is running against Republican Representative Rick Berg. Heitkamp has sought to tie Berg to the deeply unpopular House of Representatives. In fact, many of the new Republican candidates for Senate are current or recently departed members of Congress, and that could help the Democrats. Approval ratings right now are so abysmally bad, it has to rub off on members seeking higher office, said political analyst Stuart Rothenberg. What about the House? Well, Republicans currently have a 242-190 advantage there, and Democrats would need to pick up 28 seats to recapture the House. Some Democratic Party leaders think they have a shot, but history suggests their chances are slim. When the presidency and Congress are split between two parties, said political analyst Harry Enten, voters tend to like the status quo because they feel that divided government keeps the ideologues in both parties in check. Most forecasts have House Democrats picking up between 10 and 15 seats, leaving the GOP in the majority. Are Republicans likely to win the Senate? It may partly depend on what happens in the presidential election. If President Obama wins against his likely opponent, Mitt Romney, then Republicans would need to buck more than a century of history to swing the Senate. No incumbent president since the 19th century has been reelected while his party lost control of the Senate. But with so many Democratic seats in play, Republicans could make history in 2012. Whatever the outcome, though, the upper chamber will remain mired in partisan gridlock. Neither party has a chance of hitting the filibuster-proof figure of 60 seats, and in recent years, Republicans have turned the filibuster from a rarely used tactic into a means to block the majority's will. If they become the minority, Democrats will undoubtedly return the favor. That means the new Senate will do what Senates do best, said political scientist Larry Sabato. A whole lot of nothing. And the footnote to this article, there's always next time. If Republicans don't retake the Senate this November, their odds are already looking good for 2014. Democrats will again have more seats up for re-election that year than Republicans will, 20 as things stand, to the GOP's 13, and many will be hard to retain, especially in red states like South Dakota, Louisiana, Montana, Alaska, and North Carolina. And if Obama is still in the White House, Republicans will have history on their side, as second midterm elections frequently go badly for the president's party. George W. Bush lost 6 Senate seats in his second midterm in 2006, and Ronald Reagan lost 8 in 1986. All of this means both short-term and long-term concern for Senate Democrats, said Stuart Rothenberg. You're listening to our Reading of the Week magazine here on the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Now we'll turn to the best columns of the week in the United States, according to the Week magazine. Our first one is entitled Classifying Hispanics by Skin Color, written by Ruben Navarrete Jr. in CNN.com. The Trayvon Martin case has introduced a new phrase to our cultural lexicon, said Ruben Navarrete Jr. That's white Hispanic, the national media's way of describing the face of George Zimmerman, who shot and killed Martin in February. Initial reports said Zimmerman was white, fueling the impression that the shooting was motivated by race. But Zimmerman's father said that because his son identifies as Hispanic, his mother is from Peru, he couldn't have racist feelings toward blacks. That's ridiculous. Everyone is capable of being a bigot, and being the member of a minority group doesn't make you immune to those impulses. But it's worth asking why the media seems to be bending over backward to label Zimmerman a white Hispanic. My guess is that it's a way of trying to cover the earlier mistake and keep the racial narrative simple. Whatever the reason, I don't like it. My skin color is light brown. Does that make me a beige Hispanic? Creating more racial subcategories only invites more racial division, and that's the last thing our country needs. The next column is entitled, It's Time to Kill the Penny, and it's written by John Fund in NationalReview.com. Should we make sense? Asked John Fund. Our friends in Canada no longer think so. The Canadians have decided to stop minting pennies next year on the grounds that the coins have become a nuisance. The U.S. should follow suit. Each penny costs more than a cent to mint, so the U.S. Treasury loses more than $100 million a year on the coin's production. Many people no longer value them. So many of the 4.3 billion pennies the Treasury churns out every year end up being thrown in jars or lost down the backs of sofas. Drop a penny on the street and no one even bothers picking it up. Pennies are also a waste of time. An MIT scientist has calculated that we each spend 2.4 hours a year counting out pennies in stores. Supporters of the penny warn that eliminating the coin will cause retailers to round up prices to the nearest 5 cents. Even if that were true in every case, consumers would lose all of $18.25 a year. So let's consign this grubby little coin to history. When 1 cent has become essentially worthless, a penny saved is no longer a penny earned. And our next column from the Week magazine is Baseball Still the Best Sport, Michael Kassin writes in the New Republic. Baseball may no longer be America's most popular spectator sport, said Michael Kassin, but it's still the best one. Major League Baseball opened its 142nd consecutive season this week, healthier than it's been in years, without the dysfunction, scandal, and discontent currently plaguing basketball and football. Baseball fans get a much better deal for starters. You can catch a game for an average of $27, far less than the $48 it costs to see an NBA game in a season shortened by a bitter labor strike, or the $113 average ticket to a gridiron bruise-a-thon. Baseball treats its players better, too. It pays rookies a healthy $500,000 and even issues checks to minor leaguers, unlike football and basketball, which draft student athletes exploited by the NCAA. Nor does baseball entertain by displays of the vicious brutality that has left so many football and hockey players with multiple concussions and brain damage. Baseball's appeal is its beautiful simplicity, its anti-modernity. Nothing beats walking into a ballpark on a spring day to take pleasure in a game whose rules and aesthetics have changed little since Grover Cleveland lived in the White House. And now we'll flip to the back of the magazine here for a look at this week's Last Word. The article this week is entitled, The Lazarus Bug. This giant insect was thought to be extinct, says Robert Krulwich, until two scientists took a hike in the dark. They call it Ball's Pyramid. It's what's left of an old volcano that emerged from the sea about 7 million years ago. A British naval officer named Ball was the first European to see it in 1788. It sits off Australia in the South Pacific. It is extremely narrow, 1,844 feet high, and it sits alone. For years, this place had a secret. About halfway up the volcano, at 225 feet above sea level, hanging on the rock surface, there is a small, spindly little bush, and under that bush, a few years ago, two climbers, working in the dark, found something totally improbable hiding in the soil. How it got there, we still don't know. About 13 miles from this spindle of rock, there's a bigger island called Lord Howe Island. On Howe, there used to be an insect famous for being big. It's a stick insect, a critter that masquerades as a piece of wood. And the Lord Howe Island version was so large, as big as a human hand, that the Europeans labeled it a tree lobster, because of its size and hard, lobster-like exoskeleton. It was 4.5 inches long and the heaviest flightless stick insect in the world. Local fishermen used to put them on fishing hooks and use them as bait. Then one day in 1918, a supply ship, the SS Macombo from Britain, ran aground at Lord Howe Island and had to be evacuated. One passenger drowned. The rest were put ashore. It took 9 days to repair the Macombo, and during that time, some black rats managed to get from the ship to the island, where they instantly discovered a delicious new rat food, giant stick insects. 2 years later, the rats were everywhere, and the tree lobsters were gone. Totally gone. After 1920, there wasn't a single sighting. By 1960, the Lord Howe walking stick insect, Dryocochlius australis, was presumed extinct. There was a rumor, though. Some climbers scaling Ball's Pyramid in the 1960s said they'd seen a few stick insect corpses lying on the rocks that looked recently dead. But the species is nocturnal, and nobody wanted to scale the spire hunting for bugs in the dark. Fast forward to 2001, when two Australian scientists, David Priddle and Nicholas Carlisle, with two assistants, decided to take a closer look. From the water, they'd seen a few patches of vegetation that just might support walking sticks. So they boated over. Swimming would have been much easier, Carlisle said, but there are just too many sharks. They crawled up the vertical rock face to about 500 feet, where they found a few crickets, nothing special. But on their way down, on a precarious, unstable rock surface, they saw a single Melaleuca bush peeping out of a crack and underneath what looked like fresh droppings of some large insect. Where, they wondered, did that poop come from? The only thing to do was to go back up after dark with flashlights and cameras to see if the pooper would be out taking a nighttime walk. Carlisle and a local ranger, Dean Hiscox, agreed to make the climb, and with flashlights they scaled a wall till they reached the plant, and there, spread out on the bushy surface, were two enormous, shiny, black-looking bodies. And below those two, slithering into the muck, were more and more, 24 in all gathered near this one plant. They were alive, and to Carlisle's eye, enormous. Looking at them, he said, it felt like stepping back into the Jurassic Age when insects ruled the world. They were Dryocochlius australis. A search the next morning and 2 years later concluded that these were the only ones on Ball's Pyramid, the last ones. They live there and, as best we know, nowhere else. How they got there is a mystery. Maybe they hitchhiked on birds or traveled with fishermen. How they survived for so long on just a single patch of plants, nobody knows either. The important thing, the scientists thought, was to get a few of these insects protected and into a breeding program. Well, that wasn't so easy. The Australian government didn't know if the animals on Ball's Pyramid could or should be moved. There were meetings, studies, 2 years passed, and finally officials agreed to allow four animals to be retrieved, just four. When the team went back to collect them, it turned out there had been a rock slide on the mountain, and at first they feared that the whole population had been wiped out. But when they got back up to the site on Valentine's Day in 2003, the animals were still there, sitting on and around their bush. The plan was to take one pair and give it to a man who was very familiar with mainland walking stick insects, a private breeder living in Sydney. He got his pair, but within 2 weeks they died. That left the other two. They were named Adam and Eve, taken to the Melbourne Zoo and placed with Patrick Honan, then with the zoo's invertebrate conservation breeding group. At first, everything went well. Eve began laying little pea-shaped eggs, exactly as hoped. But then she got sick. According to biologist Jane Goodall, writing for Discover, Eve became very, very sick. Patrick worked every night for a month, desperately trying to cure her. Eventually, based on gut instinct, Patrick concocted a mixture that included calcium and nectar and fed it to his patient, drop by drop, as she lay curled up in his hand. Her recovery was almost instant. Honan told the Australian Broadcasting Company, she went from being on her back, curled up in my hand, almost as good as dead, to being up and walking around within a couple of hours. Eve's eggs were harvested, incubated, though it turns out only the first 30 were fertile, and became the foundation of the zoo's new population of walking sticks. When Goodall visited in 2008, Honan showed her rows and rows of incubating eggs, 11,376 at that time, with about 700 adults in the captive population. Lord Howe Island walking sticks seemed to pair off an unusual insect behavior, and Goodall says Honan showed me photos of how they sleep at night in pairs, the male with three of his legs protectively over the female beside him. Now comes the question that bedevils all such conservation rescue stories. Once a rare animal is safe at the zoo, when can we release it back to the wild? On Lord Howe Island, their former habitat, the great-great-great-grandkids of those original black rats are still out and about, presumably hungry, and still a problem. Step one, therefore, would be to mount an intensive and expensive rat annihilation program. Residents would, no doubt, be happy to go rat-free, but not every Lord Howe Islander wants to make the neighborhood safe for gigantic hard-shell crawling insects. So the Melbourne Museum is mulling over a public relations campaign to make these insects more, well, adorable or noble or whatever it takes. The museum recently made a video with strumming guitars featuring a brand-new baby emerging from its egg. The newborn is emerald green, squirmy, and so long that it just keeps coming and coming from an impossibly small container. Will this soften the hearts of Lord Howe Islanders? I don't know. It's so, so big. Well, what happens next? Well, the story is simple. A bunch of black rats almost wiped out a bunch of gigantic bugs on a little island far away from most of us. A few dedicated scientists, passionate about biological diversity, risked their lives to keep the bugs going. For the bugs to get their homes and their future back doesn't depend on scientists anymore. They've done their job. Now it's up to the folks on Lord Howe Island. Will ordinary Janes and Joes, going about their days, agree to spend a little extra effort and money to preserve an animal that isn't what most of us would call beautiful? Its main attraction is that it has lived on the planet for a long time, and we have the power to keep it around. I don't know if it will work, but in the end, that's the walking stick's best argument. I'm still here, so don't let me go. And that article was copyrighted in 2012 by National Public Radio. The NPR News report titled, Six-Legged Giant Finds Secret Hideaway. And now we'll turn to the Talking Point section in the Week magazine for the week, April 13th, 2012. The first item is Young Adult Fiction, Not for Grown-Ups. If there's anything more embarrassing than catching adults ogling porno on their iPads or computers, said Joel Stein in NYTimes.com, it's spotting them reading Harry Potter, a Twilight book, or The Hunger Games. Millions of grown men and women are reading these children's books, helping to turn the so-called young adult genre into a phenomenon. Sales of fictional books aimed at children and young adults aged 14 to 21 rose by over 60% last year. The Hunger Games alone has sold 23 million copies. Almost 10,000 different young adult books were published last year, up nearly a third since 2008. A surge driven by adults who, frankly, should be reading more challenging, age-appropriate material. As for me, I'll read The Hunger Games when I finish the previous 3,000 years of adult fiction. Yet tween girls have their own little world of vampires and child wizards. Ah, what a pity we aren't all as clever and sophisticated as Joel Stein, said Alyssa Rosenberg in thinkprogress.org. But his snide dismissal of an entire category of fiction is pure hogwash. Young people are fully capable of sophisticated reasoning and empathy, and the best young adult novels explore complex, morally challenging issues. Katniss, the heroine of The Hunger Games, discovers the horror of surrendering your sexual and romantic autonomy, while the Harry Potter novels explore the evils of torture and nasty class bias. And while all adults should experience the dense, lyrical, descriptive prose of real literary fiction, said Lev Grossman in NYTimes.com, there's nothing wrong with enjoying the simpler prose and dramatic plots of novels written for younger readers. Books for teens are built to grab your attention and hold it, and sometimes you'd prefer that to, say, decoding Thomas Pynchon. Exactly right, said Allison Flood in theguardian.co.uk. Not all reading must be difficult and educational. At the end of a long day, I sometimes crave the mental equivalent of a bar of chocolate. That's when I turn to novels about vampires, wizards, and murderous but beautiful teenagers. For most adults, said Sheila Hetty in the Globe and Mail in Canada, life consists of trudging back and forth to a repetitive job for decades and a home life that's a series of responsibilities. Is it really so surprising that grown-ups might want to occasionally lose themselves in imaginary worlds? The next item is entitled, Bullying, Is This a Crisis? Or is the crisis a myth? An epidemic of bullying has taken over our schools, said Claudia Puig in USA Today. More than 13 million children and teens this year will be subjected to heartbreaking cruelty, gay bashing, and harassment. That's the message of the documentary Bully, which opened last week amid controversy over its disturbing content, rough language, and R rating, which prevents kids under 17 from seeing it. The film follows five children who are taunted and even physically abused while school officials fail to recognize the dire and insidious problem that is all around them. Digital technology has extended bullies' reach right into the victims' homes, said Zoriana Kitt in Reuters.com, where they are tormented 24/7. As a result, untold numbers of shy or different young people suffer from shattered self-esteem and depression. Some, like Rutgers' Tyler Clementi, even commit suicide. This bullying crisis is largely a myth, said Nick Gillespie in the Wall Street Journal. Studies show that by most standards, kids today are safer and better behaved than they were when I was growing up in the 1970s and 80s. Adolescent mortality, accidents, sex, and drug use are all down from their levels of a few decades ago. Acceptance of homosexuality is up, and the percentage of students who reported being afraid of attack or harm at school has declined from 12% in 1995 to 4% in 2009. The crisis has been ginned up because now that schools are peanut-free, latex-free, and soda-free, parents, administrators, and teachers have got to worry about something. Easy for you to say, said high school student Katie Butler in the DailyBeast.com. When I came out as a lesbian in middle school in Plymouth, Michigan, my entire class of 200 turned against me. Kids pushed me up against walls and called me fag and dyke. One bully slammed my hand into a locker and broke my finger. Students all across Michigan have told stories like mine. Nationwide, 43% of teens say they've been bullied, and 160,000 kids stay home from school every day rather than face their bullies. As the movie Bully demonstrates so powerfully, this is not a mythical epidemic, said Mike Huckabee, also in the DailyBeast.com, nor is the fight against school bullying a liberal or conservative cause. Surely we can all agree that at school or on the Internet, no child should be subjected to harassment, humiliation, or violence. The next item in Talking Points this week is Romney, a widening gender gap. The Republican Party has a serious woman problem, said Steve Kornacki in Salon.com. A new USA Today Gallup poll of 12 swing states found that while the GOP's presumptive nominee, Mitt Romney, has a slight lead over President Obama among men, 48-47%, he has fallen behind among female voters by a stunning 18 points. That yawning gender gap gives Obama an overall lead of 51-42% in the battleground states, a dramatic shift from mid-February, when the same poll put Romney ahead of Obama by 2 points. Is anyone really surprised? Said Marcos Moulistas in The Hill. Republicans just spent a month attacking the idea that contraception should be covered by health plans. Romney has called Roe v. Wade one of the darkest moments in Supreme Court history and has pledged to pull federal funding from Planned Parenthood, though 1 in 5 American women have gotten health care from the service. By pandering to the GOP base, Romney has set himself up for an electoral backlash from tens of millions of enraged and highly motivated women. The recent polling looks bad, said David Paul Kuhn in RealClearPolitics.com, but the media always exaggerates poll trends. Romney was trailing Obama among women even before the contraception debate erupted. It's true that he has no chance of winning in November if his support among women remains at 37%, but early head-to-head polls are not historically predictive. Some 37% of women supported George W. Bush in a February 2000 poll, but he claimed 43% on Election Day. It's not too late for Romney to win women back. He should play down the Planned Parenthood and abortion talk and focus on the economy, gas prices, and the deficit. Many issues that rally feminist groups, abortion for example, do not drive the votes of most women. Romney is keenly aware of his problem with women voters, said Molly Ball in the Atlantic.com. That's why he has been deploying his charming wife, Anne, to do women's outreach. Her message is how concerned women are about the deficit. The good news for Romney and William McGurn in the Wall Street, said William McGurn in the Wall Street Journal, is that in the USA Today Gallup poll, women ranked birth control as the last of their national priorities. The bad news? His inability to generate much excitement among women appears related to a general inability to generate much excitement among anyone. And now, some good news from the health and science section this week as we reach the end of the program here. Popcorn offers a great healthy benefit. Popcorn offers more than crunch and empty calories. A new study shows that the snack food is more nutritious than fruits and vegetables in some respects, provided you don't slather it with butter and salt. Researchers at the University of Scranton in Pennsylvania ran tests on several different popcorn brands and found that the hulls, the tough fragments that get stuck in your teeth, contained surprisingly high levels of antioxidants called polyphenols, which have been found to reduce the risk of cancer and heart disease. A serving of popcorn provides more than twice the polyphenols as a similar serving of most fruits and vegetables. And because it contains little water, popcorn's nutritional benefits are more highly concentrated. As a whole grain, popcorn also boasts higher concentrations of fiber than cereals or breads do. Popcorn may be the perfect snack food, study author Joe Vinson tells ScienceDaily.com, and the whole fragments in particular are nutritional gold nuggets. When air popped, the snack contains far fewer calories than snacks like chips or trail mix. Popcorn does, however, lack the important vitamins and minerals that are packed into foods like broccoli and bananas. And now we'll take a look at a few short items here from the Talking Point section as we reach the end of our program. More than 10 million U.S. housing units, about 10% of all occupied homes, are now in gated communities like the one in which Trayvon Martin was killed. Between 2001 and 2009, the United States saw a 53% growth in housing units in gated communities. Conservative Americans are losing trust in science, a University of North Carolina study found. In 1974, 48% of conservatives reported a great deal of trust in the scientific community, about the same as liberals. But by 2010, only 35% of conservatives reported that level of trust. Liberals have remained constant at 47% and independents at 42%. Tickets for last week's $640 million Mega Millions lottery jackpot, the largest in history, were selling at the rate of 1 million per hour in the 48 hours before the drawing. A 2008 study found that households with annual incomes less than $13,000 spend an average of 9% of their money on lottery tickets. And Americans age 60 or over still owe $36 billion on student loans. According to new research, some older Americans are still paying off their original loans. Others took on new debt after returning to school. And many have co-signed for loans with their children or grandchildren. Our poll watch this week, oral arguments before the U.S. Supreme Court on the health care reform law did not change many minds. 63% said that what they heard of the arguments did not affect their opinion of the law, while 23% said they now have a less favorable opinion. 7% said they have a more favorable opinion. 65% said their opinion of the Supreme Court itself was unchanged, while 21% said it had become more negative. We've just about run out of time for this week's edition of The Week magazine. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm George Douglas. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. So long until next time.